Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 127. Child Martyrs and Militant Evangelization in New Spain. An interview with Stephanie Schmidt. One of the defining elements of the Spanish imperial system was conversion of the peoples who were incorporated into it to Christianity. It was often one of the core reasons which it gave for undertaking its conquests. And today the religion is firmly established across Latin America. We've talked a little bit about missionary work on this podcast, but not yet in fine detail. If history is both about the big events and the stories of people or groups of people on the ground, then there's a lot to learn by examining what these conversion attempts were like for the people doing them and the people subject to them. So what did missionary work actually look like on a local level? How did the people doing it see themselves? And how did the people they were attempting to convert interpret their work and react to it? Today, Stephanie is going to tell us about her new book, which recounts a group of stories from the years immediately after the conquest of Mexico and helps to answer some of these questions. The stories are tragic ones, but they show us how the process of conversion actually worked in those earliest years, and how it could go wrong. They also tell us a lot more about that new society. They show us how the missionaries saw themselves, or at least how they wanted to present their work, as well as how others saw them. They tell us how leaders of conquered societies interacted with the colonial apparatus, and how that apparatus attempted to set itself up in those first years when the Spanish were few and far between. Most relevantly, though, they tell us how indigenous people responded to conversion attempts, including the children, who form the main protagonists of these stories. Okay, well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What was the setting of the stories you tell in your book? I know we're talking about Spanish Mexico, but how soon after the conquest did these events take place? And what did colonial and religious society look like at the time?
So I'm looking at kind of the mid to late 1520s. This is less than 10 years after the conquest of Mexico. And this is just this very early time when the first missionaries have arrived in Mexico. When at the very beginning, when the missionaries arrived, people were still worshiping as they had always worshiped. Temples were largely intact. Native priests were in these temple complexes and religious ceremonies were ongoing every 20 days. There were these 20-day-long feast cycles that was ongoing. The Spaniards who were in Mexico City were very busy with the business of conquest, with the business of mining, with the business of setting themselves up and not terribly attentive to matters of religion. So when the friars arrived, there were just 12 of them at the beginning, and there were three Franciscans who had come the previous year. So you've got 15 friars that are charged with converting this extremely densely populated region with various major urban centers and multiple languages. The language of Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs and their neighbors, was like a lengua franca, the big, widely spoken language, but there were lots of other languages. And so, you know, they arrived in this place where very sophisticated religious cultures, lots of people, no access to the language, and they were supposed to make Christians of the people. So daunting task for the friars. Their method was to set up little Franciscan houses, they like casas de Dios or like convent monasteries in major urban centers. They started with four urban centers, one of them Mexico, Tenochtitlan, and a few other surrounding cities, quickly expanded to five and then built some additional like centers. And in these like, you know, very early like religious centers or, you know, chapels, they built school boarding facilities, and the native elites were required to send their kids to study with the friars. The first phase of evangelization focused on kids. And there were two reasons, both of them strategic, One, the friars wanted to produce Christian leaders in the next generation. They recognized that it was extremely difficult to convert adults who were already mature in their sense of self, in their understanding of the world, in their understanding of the sacred. But also, the friars needed helpers. At first, they needed language helpers. They had no Nahuatl. And so their students were their teachers. And they tell us some really interesting things about how they worked with the kids to learn some Nahuatl. And they found that their students learned faster than they did. So their students were learning Spanish faster than they were learning Nahuatl. And very soon, they were using these students as intermediaries, between the group of friars, small little group of friars, and the people. So they would take the kids out as interpreters. And then pretty soon, these brand new child converts who only had probably not a terribly complete ability to communicate with the friars yet, they were sent out as child evangelists. So they would send them out in groups of two to evangelize to the people because the friars were very small in number. They had no way to do this. And then for those who will read my book, we'll find out that the story quickly takes a darker turn as these kids are used to inform on parents who have been baptized for diplomatic purposes. Like these are, lordly parents, ruler parents who receive baptism as, as a kind of a diplomatic effort, but did not, have any deeper transformation or even willing transformation. No. But so the kids were sent out to inform on parents who continue to revere their deities. They were sent out to disrupt religious ceremonies. They were taken with the friars to topple and burn temples, and they were sent out to confiscate sacred items. And so, very quickly, the friars' efforts with the kids became one of their base points to start a program of forceful, coercive conversion, by attempting to eradicate any practice or any physical object linked to ancestral religion.
So the first two stories that you tell are about Cristobalito and about Antonio and Juan. So who were these boys and what happened to them?
So Cristobalito is the son of a ruling noble, and Antonio is also the son or the grandson, actually, of the primary ruler of Tlaxcala, and Juan is the servant of Antonio that is also at the school with him. So Cristobalito was this little boy who was apparently the favorite son of his very powerful father and was supposed to be, the heir of his father. And he was taken into the mission school and converted to Christianity. And then he went back to his home and started to try to convince his father to abandon his religion, to stop worshiping the gods of his people. And the father, of course, didn't want to do that because that was his religion and that was his sacred culture. So things escalated to the point that Cristobalito started just destroying his father's sacred images in front of his father, and he got killed. So this terrible climax happens in the story in which the father kills his son for desecrating, the family altar and so forth. And then we have a similar story with Antonio and Juan. 2 years later, they are sent out not to their families, but to a neighboring town, and they just march into houses uninvited and in to kind of temples and start confiscating sacred images. And the people of this town are, shocked, obviously, at what's happened and begin to beat the boys, and the boys are killed. And so you have these two terrible stories of kids that get killed in a confrontation of religion. And of course, we have to remember that the friars are sending them into these confrontations, which are, of course, like extraordinarily fraught and very dangerous for kids. So the result is you have kids that get killed. And again, I think if we we backpedal and we look at this from removed from the context and say, oh my goodness, like that's awful. And oh my goodness, like, of course, really bad stuff went down because this is, a very, forceful clash of two religions and a very kind of violent attempt to forcefully convert, an entire people. And why were kids doing this job? Like what, who would have sent children in to do this job? But as the stories get told by one Franciscan historian and then later kind of get picked up by other Franciscan and other Spanish historians, it's told as a story of Christian martyrs. It's told as a story of evidence of God's work being done. Like, oh, this is, we know stories of child martyrs. We've seen this happen before. You get this narrative that's produced about these events, and this is a narrative that fits into a genre that the friars recognize. This is a story of martyrs, and oh my goodness, they look like they might be saints, but maybe they'll be canonized in the future. So it gets told as a martyr story, as a story that implicitly justifies the kinds of methods of evangelization that were going on, and that implicitly stands to verify for the friars that indeed they planted like the true church. What really interested me about this story is that, there were other people writing in, the same context that told the story a little differently. Indigenous historians didn't tell the story this way. They told the story about a violent clash of religion in which not just kids, but adults got killed for practicing their religion. And I think we can question that conversion of the story into this, the story of martyrs. It tells the story of the church planted, and we can say, I think actually there may have been something much more complicated happening.
And so the third story begins in a similar way, but the actions of its protagonists presented a challenge for the missionaries and for the chroniclers that you were just talking about. So what happened on this occasion?
So they're very early on when the friars first come to New Spain and they set up their monasteries, and we haven't even gotten to 1525. So late 1524, we've got this first crop of child converts, and they probably don't speak much Spanish yet, and the friars certainly don't speak any Nahuatl yet. They're interpreters. Maybe they have a few loose phrases they're trying desperately to learn, but they're teaching these kids some fundamentals of Christian doctrine. And we have to understand like that this is like very, it's got to be very basic because there's very little communication happening. I mean, it's the friars themselves and their stories tell us this is what we taught them. God is good, your gods are bad, and this is heaven, this is hell, this is the Virgin Mary, and here are a few prayers. Like, oh, and here are the Ten Commandments. That's about as far as they got at the very beginning. And so you have these kids that are, just taken away from their parents. They're now housed with these friars. They've got the rudiments of communication. They're becoming Christian in the most, very, very incipient way. And they have been told, one of the big messages that comes across is the gods of your people are demons, and we need to give battle to the devil. This is the message that they're getting. Now, you asked me earlier, what does it look like at the very beginning? What does this context look like when the first missionaries come and the Spaniards have just arrived and are setting themselves up? What do things look like on the ground? Well, through the end of 1524, when after the missionaries had arrived, ancestral religion was still being publicly practiced. So there were still ceremonies going on. We have sources that tell us that human sacrifice was still happening in front of not just the Spanish, but also the friars, right? So we have some sources that tell us that. We have in these native ceremonial complexes, you have priests of various Central Mexican deities. So in Tlaxcala, in late 1524, when the first child converts are living in their monastery school, they went out one day to bathe at the river. And when they were crossing the Tianguis, the big market square, they had a confrontation with a Nahua priest who was dressed to represent or to embody a native deity, Ometlotl, which would translate as two rabbit. And so he was proceeding through the market, dressed as the deity, representing the deity. People were following behind, and this priest and the kids interact. And the priest basically tells them, like, ooh, you should not be, in the house of Dios and the, with the friars worshiping like God and Mary. You shouldn't be over there. Things aren't going to go so good if you abandon our gods. And these kids have been trained, your gods are the devil. And here is this man, this priest, who is dressed as one of their deities. And so the disagreement escalates, and it ends in these young child converts picking up stones and stoning this Nahua priest. Utterly shocking, of course, for the people. Like, this is this figure of like respect, but they kill. And they go back, and they're kids, right? Like, these are adolescents. And as you read like the friars' accounts of this story, you can kind of get this sense of these, I don't know, 12, 13, 14-year-olds who don't fully understand the gravity of what has happened and are clearly like applying this missionary doctrine in ways that were not quite intended. And the friars are horrified, and they say, who did this? And they have him punished, or they have the boys responsible punished, and they go out and see, and indeed they find this priest dead in the plaza, like having been bloodied and stoned with the insignias and the costume of this local deity. But the fascinating thing about one of the fascinating things about this story is that the first friar historian Motolinía, who tells this story, he says, and yet the people saw that their priest fell, and they began to believe that our God was powerful, something to that effect. And so he takes this very troubling, moment that the friars were disturbed by. They were not trying to send their child converts or young students out to kill people. But he takes this and he folds this into a larger story of, and thus God did his work. And so, from the get-go, as it's first narrated by one of the friars on the ground there, it's this, very kind of troubling and layered story of, oops, something went wrong, and yet God used this. There's a lot to say about this story, but from just reading that one, missionary account of it, yeah, you have to do a double take as you read it of, oh my goodness, what happened here? And of course, when you read Nahua histories about the same series of events, they tell them in a different way.
Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Warpath. The men of Second Company had their mission, but war is never predictable, and even the best-laid plans crumble under the chaos of battle. If you're the kind of person who thrives in that environment and loves tactical decision-making, then you need to check out Warpath, a strategy game that lets you immerse yourself in battles with realistic terrain, sound, and gorgeous visuals. With over 30 million downloads and a 4.6 star rating on iOS, Warpath lets you build the ultimate armory, customizing over 300 units with 1,000 unique modifications, and allowing you to forge real-life weapon parts to upgrade your arsenal. But brute force alone won't win the war. Like the Colonel, you need strategy. Thanks to Warpath's responsive RTS controls, you can use tactical positioning, air support, and flanking maneuvers to outwit your enemy in massive battles. You can employ creative solutions to take out your enemy by using sniper rifles, for instance. And the best part? You're never out of the fight. Rapid recruitment lets you reinforce your troops when they're in the field. And even if you're defeated, you keep all of your resources. Experience an ever-shifting battlefield with army groups, artillery, flanking, air support, and more in this fun-filled war simulator game. So if you're ready to test your courage, tactics, and mettle against brilliant commanders from around the world, download Warpath today on PC or mobile by using the link in the description. So you've touched on it a bit there, but you devote a lot of time in the book to talking about the different writers, when they were writing and who they were and how they present their stories differently. So who were the different writers and what were they hoping to achieve beyond simply recording history?
I've mentioned the name Motolinía. Motolinía was one of the first 12 Franciscans to arrive in New Spain, and he was a major historian of this moment. He wrote extensively about the history of evangelization, but like many others in his time, he was also very interested in the stories and the culture and the deities and the traditions of the peoples that he was evangelizing. And so he also included content about, the cultures of the Nahuas in central Mexico. And he was hugely influenced and influential because historian after historian in the colonial period took his writings and folded them into their own histories. Much of the content of his writings got reproduced and then kind of spread in the context of various histories. And so this is the missionary friar that wrote the stories about these boys, and his version of what happened became the official story. His interest in writing was one to tell the story of his own life work and the life work of his brethren. They felt like they were in one of those huge moments in world history and in the history of the church. They understood themselves as bringing Christianity across the ocean, fulfilling, the great commission of Christ to spread the word to the uttermost parts of the earth. Like, that's what they believed they were doing, and they thought it was so important. And so they wanted to tell their story. They were also explicitly interested in telling their version of the story because there were other kinds of stories circulating among Spaniards about what they were doing. Not the friars often clashed with the conquistadors on a few different levels, and the friars were very critical of the military violence that like the conquistadors were using. And they called them the secular Spaniards, or the conquistadors were also critical of the friars because they sometimes felt like their missionary violence, their conversion by force, was too much. And there were some critical moments where they thought, oh, you guys are gonna upset the fragile peace if you push too hard. Oh my goodness, you're going out and destroying sacred images. You just toppled some temples. Why did you do that? That's dangerous. That's reckless. Give it some time. Don't push so hard. And so there was pushback in two directions, and the friars were interested in telling their version of the story. And he wasn't alone. There were many who came behind him that were, writing, this is the story of what we did. This is the story of what happened. This is the story of the great work that we spearheaded. But they were also, Motolinía and other friars of his generation were also aware that they had come to a place with a really rich cultural tradition. It was a book culture. There were painted books in central Mexico. There was like an extraordinarily sophisticated religious culture. There was just a lot there, and the friars were fascinated, and they wanted to be the ones to write it down and to publish it. So there was some of that too.
One of my later questions was about how the rest of society viewed what the friars were doing. You sort of answered that there. Do you have anything else to say on that?
I think it's just important to note that when friars like Motolinía and folks who came behind him, 20, 30, 40 years later to write the same set of stories, when they were writing, of course, they wanted to tell the stories. They believed that God was using them. There were mass baptisms, and they thought that this was miraculous. And they wanted to tell that story, but they were defending their work. They were defending their life work from detractors. And one set of detractors was the conquistador class, who, frankly, the concerns weren't moral. It wasn't at the level of, ooh, it's not very respectful to go in and destroy people's temples and sacred items. That's why would you do that? No. They were perfectly fine with that. But it was just a practical, like, ooh, politically, that's not smart because there are not enough of us here yet. And if you go and you are violently destroy sacred property, you're going to upset people because that's kind of sensitive. And it was also apparently, again, that according to the friars who wrote about it, there were some that were saying, oh, when you go in and you burn down, like burn the roofs and destroy the items inside these temples, you're destroying really expensive stuff. What are you doing? Wouldn't it be better to plunder that? You know, there was some of that too. But then there was another set of detractors and who had like moral questions. So Bartolomé de las Casas, right? Like the famous Bishop of Chiapas who wrote to defend like human rights essentially in you know the first 100 years of after the conquest, even less, but the first 50 years we'll say. You know, he was very critical of the way that conquest played out, and a lot of us are familiar with that. You know, he was saying, oh my goodness, this is bloodshed. You know, the Spaniards are acting like wolves among sheep. We're not acting like Christians, we're acting like tyrants. And so a lot of folks are familiar with that argument, but Las Casas was actually also very critical of these first Franciscan missionaries because he said, look, you're going and you're doing these mass baptisms and folks are receiving Christ, but they're not understanding what it is that they're receiving. They're accepting baptism, but there's no true conversion. And so he was like loudly critical of the methods of the early chroniclers. And then, you know, I talk in the book about one of these sources, Sorita, who was like the one historian that I feature that was not a Franciscan, but was in fact, he had been an oidor, like a judge essentially in New Spain for years. And then he, you know, took Motolinía's writings and some other writings and he wrote his own history. But he was critical of some of the measures, violent measures that the friars took, not just because it was rash, but because he felt that they were not justified in destroying the sacred property of people who were not Christians or physically punishing. There were corporal punishments of people who practiced religion, native religions who were not converts. And so he said, that's actually something that, you know, if we look back in these like early fathers of the church who wrote about what we're allowed to do and what we're not, you guys didn't have jurisdiction, like spiritual jurisdiction to go in and act with violence against people who were not Christian. The friars, when they wrote, like Motolinía, who wrote the stories of what they did, they were not just telling the story of, like, oh, this great moment that we lived. Oh, it was so good. I'm going to tell about it. So important. They're also defending their legacy on a couple different sides.
The zeal with which these boys went about their work is really quite striking. And I think what makes it even more interesting is that a lot of them were heirs to powerful positions within their indigenous societies. Those societies were now conquered, but they still existed. And so I guess the simplest explanation for why they wanted to why they went about it with so much strength is that they were brainwashed, they were kids. But you also talk about how they might have been influenced by stories of sacrifice which originated in their own cultures. You pointed out that the level of Christian instruction given to them was quite basic at this point. So why do you think they acted as they did?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting and terrible things about this story is that we know this story. We've read stories about Indigenous kids that were taken to missionary boarding schools and were subjects of cultural violence. So that is what the story is about on a really basic level. These were kids whose parents did not want to send them to be catechized by the friars, but had no choice. There was an order by Cortes that the families had to send their kids, and that order was enforced. And so, you know, the friars tell us that they did not let the kids out to see their families. There's a letter by Pedro de Gante, who was one of these early friars, and he says this: we kept them away from their families. This is this deliberate choice on the part of the adults who are running the show that they are going to raise these kids. We know that there was a rupture, that they were actually even specifically not allowed to see their moms. It breaks your heart to think about what that must have been like for these kids. And then they were re-educated in the most literal sense. They were told everything you know from before is wrong. And it's not just wrong, but it's like demonic. It's bad. And this is good. At 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 year olds, that's the age. They're let out to see their families when they go and do the friar's work, which is one, translate for the friars, two, inform on their parents, three, confiscate like sacred items, or four, go out on their own little kind of 2x2 preaching missions. So it's not hard for me to understand that that happened, that they would become kind of like zealous disciples of the friars because the kids, because they went through this trauma, and because we've seen these kinds of traumas and cultural violence play out in other circumstances. I think that that's a big part of the story of what happened. But then you comment on the fact that I write about Antonio and Juan, the second story that happened a few years after the story of Cristobalito, like how, according to the story that this missionary historian Motolinia tells, they embraced the idea of martyrdom. They went off on this mission saying, oh, we might die. And if we die, there should be some among us, you know, in New Spain who are willing to die for God. And so one of the interesting points for me is that while the friars appear to have had this reaction of, oh wow, they have become true converts. They are ready to be martyred for Christ. Maybe, and I would say probably there was a secondary influence. You know, if these kids came into the monastery at 10 or 11 or 12 or, you know, maybe 14, they had a life before that, and they were raised in a culture when warriors were expected to die on the battlefield or in sacrifice to the deities. You know, little boys, little elite boys, the midwife, their fathers, or, you know, there would be these speeches that would be offered at the birth of a child, at the birth of a male child. And it would essentially identify the fact that the young elite male's destiny was to provide food and drink for the deities in the battlefield or in the context of battle. And that would be one of two things. It would be taking captives for sacrifice to provide nourishment to the deities, who would then nourish them back with rain and kind of a reciprocal exchange, or to themselves offer their bodies, embrace the possibility that they would be taken captive and then sacrificed for the deities. These were kids from a culture that inculcated them to embrace a fate of offering oneself and one's life blood to the gods in the context of a military encounter with sacred ramifications. And we can't forget the fact that the friars were constantly framing what was happening in their conversion efforts in military terms, giving battle to the devil. They talked about a spiritual conquest. And so much of my work in this book is looking at a late 16th century Nahuatl translation of the story that this missionary friar Motolinía wrote about the child martyrs. And in that Nahuatl translation, there are some very interesting passages that suggest that Antonio and Juan understood their role with a certain influence of their own cultural tradition, embraced martyrdom from the perspective of young Nahuatl males who were raised to understand that they would one day die for the gods, or die in sacrifice for the gods. So there's kind of a layering, a suggestion of a layering of sacred understanding in these young converts, which again is, that would make sense. How could you possibly take a child raised in this, in one sacred and cultural context, and in the course of 2 years, 3 years, utterly transform them, wipe away any trace of what was before? The friars certainly influence these children heavily, but of course, they are going to carry with them much of the ways of thinking of their people, because that's who they were.
And so, how effective do you think this tactic of enlisting these boys was? Do we know if they played a significant role in the beginning of the conversion of Mexico's indigenous peoples? And for how long were these tactics used? Did they carry on for a long time, or did the friars and missionaries decide to change them?
Well, we know multiple histories from this time tell us that the kids were used as child evangelists. And it wasn't something that happened in the first 2 years before the friars learned a little bit more of the native languages. It was something that happened for quite a while. Kids were sent out into the farther flung communities in small groups. We definitely know it was still going on in the 1530s. So I write about stories that were happening in the late 1520s. But we have other sources that tell us the same thing about the 1530s. We know that over these years, more and more friars are coming as well from Spain, and not just Franciscans. You have Dominicans, you have Augustinians, and much later you have the Jesuits. But reinforcements are coming to do some of this missionary labor. But these young Nahuas were very important. They continue to be very important as interpreters. The friars worked hard to learn native languages. They had to, but they still relied a lot on interpreters for their preaching. Some were more able than others. And then they started producing missionary literature. They produced a lot of missionary literature, sermons, confessionary manuals, Christian theater, and Nahuatl. And so these young Nahuas who had studied with the friars worked not only as interpreters on the ground, but then they also worked as translators to produce like a pretty significant body of Christian literature in Nahuatl. And that went on over the course of the century. And in fact, the Nahuatl translation or version of the story of these three child martyrs was produced in large part through the efforts of Nahua intellectuals who had first studied with the friars when they were boys, and then over the course of their long lives had kind of come back to help not only teach Indigenous boys in the friar schools, but also help in these various literary projects as not just scribes, but as co-authors. So these kids were like a huge part of the evangelization that happened throughout the 16th century. But in terms of effectiveness, I mean, evangelization happened on a very large scale and there were huge numbers baptized. But like, we can't forget that the complexity of the story that we see happening in the 1520s, you know, when there are very clear influences of both Christian and Nahua thought in the converts themselves, and that, you know, all of these very interesting, very terrible things happening as religions clash. There's also a lot of complexity in the decades that follow. You know, you still see people thinking in ancestral ways, of course, like ancestral ways of thinking in terms sacred and in other cultural ways did not disappear. So you see, you know, in the 15, not just the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you see a lot of evidence of people continuing to think about the sacred in the ways that their ancestors thought about the sacred. You see people singing their songs, their like ancestral songs, and incorporating references to the Christian deity and to the Virgin Mary, but also incorporating sacred references that have nothing to do with Christianity. And so these things stay. So when we talk about effectiveness, you know, we can't think in black and white terms. Yes, Christianity spread, and no, it did not just erase ancestral forms of religion and ancestral forms of sacred thought, I should say.
That's the end of the questions I had. I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to talk about.
I think that with this book, I look beyond the Spanish story of what happened. So I take a Spanish story about child martyrs. I look at how Nahua intellectuals, former child converts themselves, rewrote the story as they worked together with a Franciscan named Juan Bautista, Fray Juan Bautista. And then I also compare kind of very interesting, subtle, but sometimes very crucial modifications that they made to that story. I compare that with Nahua histories from the same period to look at the fact that there are other versions of this story, that for Nahuas, this wasn't a story of, you know, sacred child martyrs. This was a story of religious violence. This was a story of kids that were killed, yes, and also adults that were killed by the friars because they were practicing the religion of the people. There's this fascinating history by a Nahua historian from Tlaxcala named Zapata y Mendoza, and he says that people got baptized out of fear. He just outright says it. He said, in the same period that these kids got killed, adults were getting hanged, and the people were afraid. It's not a story of providence. That's a story of something else. It's a story of coercion. So I work to look at those layers of the story and pay attention to what Nahua historians were saying in this period, kind of try to work with this Nahua version of the child martyr story to kind of pick apart those points where the Nahua intellectuals who were part of the team that produced this acknowledge layers to the story that are not present in the Spanish missionary version.
Stephanie's book is called Child Martyrs and Militant Evangelization in New Spain. It's published by the University of Texas Press, and it has just been released.